dear listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast found carrying in a cupboard when the werewolf arrives. I'm Nathan.
I'm James.
I'm Liz.
It's Doctor Who's second annual Celebrity Historical this week, so we're off to Scotland to find out what Queen Victoria thinks of Rose and our new Doctor. It's the second episode of Series 2, Tooth and Claw. So this is another Celebrity Historical just about a year after our last one. How do we think this one compares to The Unquiet Dead?
I enjoyed it a lot more than I expected to. I rewatched it again for the second time in the past couple of months because I'm doing a new Who rewatch, and I hadn't seen it for, it must have been like almost 10 years, and in my head, couldn't stand it. It's like the pinnacle of the smug 10th Doctor and Rose thing that I'm not a fan of. But I watched it this time, and I was like, okay, yeah, they're kind of smug. They're Rose's, like, I can't stand the treating Victoria as like an amusement park, but actually I really enjoy this. I really, really like it. It's a great story, great characters. It's really exciting, and it's in Scotland. And obviously, it's an incredible depiction of my beautiful country. I absolutely love that they got the ninja monks in there and our werewolves, which, if there's one thing Doctor Who does, it's depict Scotland beautifully.
So this is Wales standing for Scotland, isn't it? But it is true that there are ninja monks. Am I right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Go down the shops. Go pop along to your local loch with its miniature monster in it. out when we go hunting haggis, they're everywhere. Yeah.
Brilliant. I actually did want to talk about the monks because you know, they do kind of play a role in the plot, but their big role is this sort of pre-credit sequence, which seems very much to have been designed to kind of beef up the Next Time trailer last week.
Yeah, I think you could easily argue that was it's superfluous. It doesn't fit with the plot, but I think it's one of those things that, gosh, it's just so cool that I don't care, in all honesty. If it was a story that I hated and I wanted to find things to nitpick at it, then I could totally understand if you didn't like the story having a go at it. But because I really enjoy it, I'm like, yes, let us have just some random jumping through air in slow-mo fighting against people stuff. That's fine. That's cool.
I think, too, that it is the sort of thing that you want Doctor Who to do. You know, like if you're asking for sort of some kind of credible science fiction explanation for where they got the outfits from and, you know, where they've been training and are they Catholic or Protestant or, you know, like if you're trying, you know, if you're asking yourself those questions, you're really approaching the whole sort of thing the wrong way.
I think it's, I actually remember watching this, I was like, are they Catholic or Protestant? Because it was bothering me because I was like, do we call because there are Protestant monasteries, do we call the people there in charge father? Is that something we do? And I didn't know. It's now really bothering me though.
They do some Latin, which is sort of worth mentioning later on. They say the wolf is God and the wolf is brave over and over again when they sort of finally reveal who they are. So I'm going for Catholic, but I'd be prepared to be proved wrong.
Well, I would assume Catholic just because it's a kind of what's the right word? I don't want to say trope, the stereotype. If you're dealing with spooky stuff, then they tend to be Catholic because they're like more qualified in it. Like if you want an exorcism done, don't call a Protestant, call a Catholic priest. That's who's going to actually get rid of the ghosty for you.
Because they actually believe in God.
Well, no, I think they're just, you know, the Protestants are a bit more bloodless, a little bit more, you know, yeah. I also think that the monks are actually playing a role in distinguishing this historical from the previous historicals, because I think, you know, Russell is quoted as saying,
oh, they needed a good kick up the arse. I think that was actually Julie Gardner.
Right. Yeah. And so what you had, I think, with The Unquiet Dead was like a very kind of, you know, BBC costume drama. There's a little bit of stuff outside, but we're basically in the studio for a lot of it and everyone's wearing lovely frocks and speaking very formally. And then so we start this historical in a really vastly different way and directed a very different way as well. It's Eros Lin, yes. I think. And he's shooting, you know, everything's speeded up. You've got sort of Matrix bullet time and all of that sort of stuff happening. And I think the rest of the episode delivers on that promise in that there's heaps of sort of handheld and you know, the interiors are shot on location and stuff
Seven
like that.
Locations.
Really?
Whoa! That's amazing. Really?
Yeah, they use seven different stately homes, basically.
I think is the corridor a set?
There's some yeah, a lot of the corridors are sets. Don't know about the staircase.
Oh, well, the staircase is massive. It's definitely a location.
But a lot of the running up and down corridors, that those are sets.
Yeah, so instead of people sort of delivering kind of, you know, sort of portentous lines in sort of proper BBC RP English at each other, you have people running up and down corridors and running up and down stairs, and not just sort of the small length of corridor that you can fit into a studio, but an actual
studio one at Lime Grove.
Yeah, that's right.
It does very much feel like this is still, they're kind of in that early New Who mood of, we must distinguish ourselves from Classic Who in showing that we have a little bit more money and can do it a little bit more epic. So when we have a chase scene here, just like I said, it's huge. There's so much space. It's so fast paced. You feel like they're really racing away from this terrifying thing. And the direction during that, I absolutely love, because you barely see the wolf, but you've got it from its perspective, you've got the sound, and you feel like it's chasing you, even though they're desperately trying to save money by not showing it up.
It's a good example of how budgetary restrictions can actually improve something, because that wolf costs so much money, and they actually had to bring a guest CG artist onto the show who was specialised in animals. Because of the hair and the close-up shots. And so the cost of that was so colossal that they had to do the POV shots and lots of fast cuts, and it actually improves it that they didn't have the money.
Yeah, no, I think it works so much better, especially because CGI, no matter how good it is always going to age really badly, really quickly. But I still think the wolf looks reasonably good here. I think it looks much better than the one in Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. And that had quite a lot more money for it. It might have been a bit earlier, but still, you know, when you're like, our Doctor Who werewolf is better than one of the biggest movies of like 2 or 3 years earlier. I think I might have got that wrong. That's still pretty impressive. Mm. It still looks good. It doesn't look like it's a real wolf, but it looks pretty nifty.
I mean, you know, like it's never going to. We knew at the time it was CG. Like, no, it was kind of fooled. I mean, and you didn't think it was a man in a suit at any point, I don't think.
Well, it wasn't a real werewolf.
And it wasn't a real werewolf. They're so difficult to cast, aren't they? But
keep biting people.
I think, too, it's trying to improve on the sort of the CG Slitheen, like last year, which I actually don't mind. I have a very, like, a soft spot for the CG Slitheen in World War III, just because they were in that very first trailer and it was kind of like, oh my God, you know, we can do CG monsters now on Doctor Who. It was so exciting. But this, with the hair and the teeth and that wonderful sort of Alien 3 close-up as well that it gets to do. Yeah, I think it's impressive. We'll put a link, if we can find it, in the show notes to that. I don't know if you've heard this, Liz, but there's an interview where David Tennant talks about the guy who's in the mocap suit.
No, I haven't.
It's completely improper, but David Tennant says that he was distractingly well-proportioned and perhaps intimidatingly well-proportioned, I think, was how Tennant put it. So people had difficulty looking at the ping pong ball, you know, the ping pong ball on the stick on top of the helmet that was supposed to give them the eye line was nowhere near as compelling as the guy himself. So, yeah.
I think there's footage of that.
There is. I think there is actually footage of the guy in the motion capture thing in some special feature somewhere.
Well, it's on Confidential.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Okay. You watch Confidential in preparation for this.
Yes.
I've got to up your pay.
He's not paying me. There's a theme, I think, that runs through this entire series. And it really starts in this episode. The whole arrogance and hubris of the Doctor and Rose. How do we feel about the handling of that?
I have a lot of negative feelings about it. I had a lot more negative feelings before I rewatched the season late last year, and it's not as bad as what I remember. At the time, I was bleh about it, which is a very accurate and meaningful Scottish word that you just heard there. I think it's at its worst here. But seeing the way it goes through, I feel less angry and frustrated at it, and more just very embarrassed by it. And I'm like, oh no, stop, just stop. Which isn't the best feeling to feel about your TARDIS crew and your heroes. But you know, if the story around it's great, then I'm prepared to go with it. I think that my main problem with it is I never really feel like there's a proper payoff. I mean, yes, there's Torchwood at the end. Yes, this ends up with them getting separated. But I never get the sense that they realise, oh, if we hadn't been quite so appallingly rude and laughing whilst people were dying around us when Victoria was there, maybe this wouldn't have happened. Maybe we should self-reflect a little bit. And I don't get the feeling that ever happens, which, you know, would be nice. I don't need a lot of self-reflection, just a little bit, just a little acknowledgement that, oh God, they're walking away at the end of this adventure, and it's clearly delivered. They're walking away, they're having a laugh about werewolves. We cut back to the Torchwood house, and we've got two widows here, one of them brand new widow grieving, and the contrast is like, we're meant to think they're behaving like, I don't know if I can say asses.
Yes.
Is that okay? They're behaving like utter asses, and we're absolutely meant to condemn that behaviour. But where's my gosh darned payoff by the end of the season, where they're like, oh, maybe, you know, learn something from it?
You know, originally I had thought that the reason was that Billy's departure had meant that, like, that there'd been some kind of long-term plan that Russell didn't get to do. But it turns out that I think it was during the shooting of this that the scripts for the two-parter at the end, like Army of Ghosts and Doomsday, like, actually arrived. So it's clear that this is working up to kind of a known end. And, like, it is a massive problem. Like, just seeing them suffer as payoff for this behaviour isn't enough if they don't learn a valuable lesson. And, like, even in Series 3, the Doctor hasn't learned a valuable lesson. He's just sort of sulking and upset because – not sulking.
He's lost his girlfriend.
Well, that's unfair, but he's upset at the loss of Rose, but he hasn't learned anything as such. And I also think it's a bit complicated too that – even if he had learnt something in episode 13, that still doesn't mean that we don't have a whole bunch of episodes where he's just being super obnoxious, and that kind of matters, I think.
Yeah, because we were still left this adventure. If you imagine this in another sort of Doctor era, it wouldn't be like that. It wouldn't be, and it. Oh, it would make it better if you didn't leave it thinking, oh my God, my TARDIS team, why? If you could leave with them cheering, or with them being a little bit, you know, say something to Flora, the poor woman's just lost her husband, a little bit of compassion and empathy there, instead of a final attempt to get Victoria to say she's not amused. I want to be on side with the TARDIS team. Is that wrong?
No, I think that's right. I think so. You talked about the, you know, trying to get her to say we're not amused. And it is this sort of thing, this tendency that we have to just regard people from early historical periods as just sort of being stupid. And I also think it's kind of magnified slightly, you know, like, I think Russell brings religion back into Doctor Who.
Mm. just an odd thing. Russell T, as far as I know, is an atheist, yes?
Yeah, I think so.
And I think he writes about religion wonderfully. I think he does a great job in it. My experience, generally speaking, is I find atheist writers actually tend to write really thoughtfully about religion. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was certainly like Eve Miles' character last year wasn't patronized for being religious. Mm. And in fact, she gets to sort of slap Rose down a little bit. Not very forcibly, but says, you just think I'm an idiot, but I'm not. I know this world. There was no religion in Doctor Who in the 70s and 80s unless you were a cultist. You know, if you worship Demnos or Logar or something, you got to be religious. Yeah, that's right. But no actual proper religious people. Mm-hmm. And I think that making her religious in a way that the Doctor and Rose aren't, and that sort of reflexive modern sort of arrogance towards that sort of really heartfelt religion, which is obviously not universal because plenty of people are religious. Like, I think that that sort of reinforces for me that sort of arrogance. You know, the Doctor and Rose know how the world works, really, you know, because they're from space and they're from the future and stuff. And so Queen Victoria is, you know, like a simple primitive to them.
Despite being the Queen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's so disrespectful.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I'm not suggesting the bounds great because she's the Queen. It's like, just treat her as though she's not there for your amusement, you know, as though she's a real person. That'd be good, you know?
And you can tell that Victoria knows what's going on. Rose is so obvious and so sort of blunt and flat-footed in the way that she tries to do it. And you can sense, I think, Queen Victoria getting more and more irritated with it.
Yeah. And it just makes me cringe. It's just one of those ones where I have to look away from the telly. Oh, no, don't, stop, stop. Like when the Doctor at the start is like, no, don't do that. And yet he lets this happen. It's, yeah. No, I'd have preferred the very dodgy Scottish accent. That would have been fine. No cringing there. That's cool. You want to do that? I don't mind.
I have to say that David Tennant doing the Scottish accent, like doing his own accent, is significantly better than his
Cod Cockney.
Yeah.
Dick Van Dyke.
It's this sort of thing where I'd kind of like David Tennant, but had sort of started to find his performance a bit more mannered, or a bit too mannered as it sort of went on. And then suddenly seeing him in Broadchurch just doing his normal voice and being sort of vastly, vastly sexier all of a sudden. And I think it's because he's not having to sort of
chew the scenery every 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know, I completely agree. I remember this was the first thing that I saw David Tennant in. And then when it was outside in another performance, it was, I think it was Blackpool I was watching with, there was a nice gif of him dancing in it or something. And I was like, whoa, this guy's actually really, really good. And then I went to see him when he was doing his Hamlet. And that was like, wow, that was amazing.
It was fantastic, wasn't it?
So great. I love the direction and stuff of that as well. The way they got the spookiness across was just, whoa. But I often feel like he's really done a sort of disservice at Doctor Who because I don't think it's one of his best performances. I think his best performance in Doctor Who is in Human Nature and Family Blood. Because
when he's not being the Doctor.
Is that terrible? I feel terrible saying that.
There's that moment in, is it Silence in the Library, where River reveals that she knows his name, and then the mask drops and it becomes clear that all of this stuff, which seems like a mannered performance, actually is a mannered performance.
By the character.
Yeah, and if that had happened a little bit more often, I would have been on board with it. Like, if it was clearer.
That makes sense.
Because the Doctor is someone who we learned last year has undergone this sort of frightful, horrific loss. And I think Christopher Eccleston made it clear when he was being jolly and putting a mask on. But in this first David Tennant series, because he's so self-satisfied, you very rarely see that mask drop at all.
Yeah, there are some really, really nice moments, though. Yeah, now you've mentioned that, I'm remembering a couple. It's there's a really nice one in Fear Her when he says, I was a father once, and you're like, a little bit of heartbreak there, because it's just, you, as you said, it just drops away the whole mask thing, and you just see this old grief in him, and it's like, whoa. And I think there's some really good stuff in with Sarah Jane as well, where he feel it's like he allows himself to be more vulnerable with her than he does around Rose, who he it feels like for her he has to put on a performance, because kind of because that's what she wants. She wants this fun, yeah. And oh, now I'm sorry, I've got half a thought here, so it's not actually sentences, because I'm just I'm speaking as I'm thinking it. But yeah, no, it's I think what you're saying is absolutely right.
I mean, it's right from that first scene where they're together in the TARDIS and they're playing in Drury and the Blockheads, and you know, the TARDIS lands and they fall over and they're just sort of laughing and things. It just sort of sets this whole scene that for them this is going to be a game. This is going to be funny all the way through, and they're here just for the laughs. Yeah. And maybe he's overcompensating. Like, you know.
They should have hung a lantern on that, though.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's it. We can't just sort of headcanon it into sort of some kind of psychological realism. It just, yeah.
Oh, I can. That's how I get through the dodgy Doctor Who. Hey, this is how I get through the twin dilemma. If I can do it for that, I can do it here. But yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, this is a lot of people's favourite season, which I completely legitimate. That's absolutely fine. And it does work for a lot of fans, which, you know. But then the Time Monster doesn't for some reason. So I can see how if you feel if Rose is your like identifying figure, if she's the one you're really connected with, then this is kind of what you want. You're in this little club of two. The Doctor adores you. He wants to entertain you. I get that, but that's not what I'm used to from my companions. I think it works a lot better if you haven't watched Doctor Who for your like childhood beforehand.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, there's sort of technical reasons. Like series one is clearly everyone sort of doing the Doctor Who story that they've had bottled up for like the last 16 years or whatever.
Yes.
You know, they've gone to the top shelf for their Doctor Who idea, and they've been given the opportunity to do it.
If we're going to kill it, yeah. We're going to make it our very best.
Yeah, but I think this one has the sort of difficult second album feel to it, because now what the hell do we do? But it also has the advantage of knowing what worked and what didn't work last time as well.
I feel I'm being very harsh on it a little bit, because I genuinely did enjoy it. And actually this season, I really enjoy it right through the Cybermen one, which I found a bit dull. And then, God help me, I don't hate Fear Her. And Satan Pitt's Impossible Planet, I think is one of the best, possibly the best story of the Russell T. Davis era. But I'm just saying that because I feel like I'm being really harsh. I'm being really mean. I still really like it. It's just really not my favourite bit of the 55 plus years.
Yeah.
Sorry, I always feel very guilty when I'm quite negative about Doctor Who, because it's like, the thing I love, and I'm criticising a part of my child. That's fine, isn't it?
It's absolutely fine. That's what we all do.
Won't cause any psychological damage.
That's it.
We all record podcasts.
Yeah, that's it.
So did you know that this story was a really late addition to the season?
I think so.
I did not.
Yeah, so initially, because they didn't want to get into a situation where if a script dropped out, they would be left having to desperately write a replacement story, Russell actually commissioned a number of scripts on spec. This was one of them. It was given to, like, a writer that never actually ended up writing for Doctor Who.
I think Russell has never said who it was.
No. And they said Queen Victoria, monks, werewolf. And the writer dropped the werewolf and the monks and rewrote the story as something about Queen Victoria getting a bug in her eye and the rest is lost to time. But and they did not like where that was heading, so they dismissed him or her, who knows. And so they actually end up in the situation that we're trying to avoid, and Russell had to write the script pretty much at the last minute.
Seems he does quite well on the last minute thing.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I think Boomtown was last minute after something dropped, and we really enjoyed that last year. And I think
that's a great one.
I think Midnight again is some equipment last placement. Minute script, yeah.
This was actually supposed to, well, this story initially was actually supposed to be episode 6.
Yeah.
And they moved it up the running order.
In fact, I'd heard that The Runaway Bride.
It was episode 6.
Yeah, and then he decided, well, that could be a Christmas special if we get a Christmas special.
Yeah, when the BBC commissioned the second Christmas special, he went, well, this is a great idea. I'm going to develop that into the Christmas special because it works so much better as a Christmas special. And you end up with Catherine Tate.
Yeah.
And then you get series 4, so it's all good. But when they got the Christmas special, he replaced Runaway Bride with this script that he wrote as a replacement for the other one. And then it got moved up the running order because there were so many delays on the other episodes.
I'd heard too that there was a toss-up whether this was going to be the first episode or the second episode.
Because New Earth had been so plagued with delays.
And it would have been possible. I think they worked it out. So, you know, the pre-credits thing at the beginning of New Earth, that could have led to the credits and then opened with the beginning of Tooth and Claw. Mm. Like, there was every possibility that it could have been first. And I think once they'd finished it, they were pretty happy with how it was going, and so that was a consideration.
Wasn't New Earth practically only finished, like, the day before broadcast or something?
Really?
Mm. There were a number of stories in the new series where they were down to the wire. They were literally finishing off the special effects and the dub and the final edits as they were prepping it for broadcast.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's like the Troughton era.
Film for life.
I think, you know, the result is probably that the story is fairly simple.
Hmm.
You know, you think sometimes with the 45-minute episodes, they're sort of trying to cram like a four-parter in there. And I think that's always a mistake.
It's a bit based on Besiege.
I read About Time earlier today, and they compared it to Horror of Fang Rock.
Mm.
That essentially you have, yeah.
It does very much feel like a modern, I know Horror of Fang Rock is Graham Williams, but it's a Hinchcliffe hangover. It does feel like the modern Hinchcliffe, taking out everything that annoys me about Hinchcliffe and keeping everything I love and then adding the Doctor and Rose.
Actually having women in your
How could you possibly think, no, that was what I was referring to? Good Lord. but it's definitely got that kind of, that gothic atmosphere, which I really love. And it is relatively straightforward, but that it makes it, it feels like it completely fits in its time slot. But drawing sort of some themes from it is kind of a bit difficult. There is the stuff about religion and the fear of, there's a lot of stuff from Victoria about knowing what's beyond and sort of both her fascination with it and her distrust of it, in that she hates the Doctor and Rose's world, but also she's really into spiritualism at this time, as she says herself, which is pretty interesting.
She's lost her husband, she's grieving, she is facing her own mortality.
Mm.
I think she's wonderful in at the dinner, you know, when they're talking about her husband, and the Doctor says to her, "You must really miss him." And she's kind of a little bit blindsided by that, as if, you know, it's not the sort of question the Queen would get asked, you know, a question about her feelings.
Intimate. It's a very intimate question from someone that doesn't know her. As a member of the royal family, she wouldn't be asked such a direct question.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I think the Doctor in that scene is much less obnoxious because, you know, Billy Piper has the day off. that day, and she's you know, Rose isn't there, and so he's not sort of showing off in front of her. You know, he's a lot more likable in that scene. And she expresses how much she misses him, but then kind of pulls herself up, and then there's the twinkle in her eye again. I think it's a good performance. We haven't even said who it is. It's Pauline Collins, of course, who was Shirley Valentine. But more importantly for us, she's she's Sam Briggs in The Faceless Ones.
Oh, I sometimes wonder what it would have been like if she'd actually been brought on as companion.
Really?
I love Victoria. Yeah, she could come along with Victoria.
Oh, yes. Her playing an older version of herself.
That would be...
Sorry, her original character and Victoria at the same time.
That would be brilliant.
Oh, I meant Waterfield. Hey, this works as well.
It could be Victoria Waterfield and Queen Victoria.
I love her performance in this. I think it's just, it's so good in that it manages to, you get the sort of standoffishness and the imperialism, and you're like, oh, yes, this is definitely a woman who's messing up the world with her ridiculous empire. Although by this point, it's more Parliament's fault. But she's also a real person. We're also invited to have compassion for her. She's very personable and interesting, and it's a nuanced performance with layers. But it doesn't. I don't feel that it whitewashes her her negative impact on history. We don't forget the imperialism here. It's mentioned several times, the empire, and I don't think it's mentioned with any sort of reverence. You could argue it's a neutral mention, but I think given what she starts at the end, given the sense of, I don't know, we must protect the British Empire from this stuff, it is a gentle condemnation. But then there's a fascinating contrast in what she says. At least this is what it made me think of, is when she says, now leave my world. The first thing I remember thinking when I heard that was the Brigadier in Battlefield, get off my world. Yeah. And they're both saying, I'm human, the Earth is my planet, and you alien person that is just not here, should be here, leave. And to say it to the Doctor is like, interesting.
It is sort of surprising that she has this terrible experience with this sort of awful monster, but her takeaway is that the Doctor and Rose are the problem. And I actually think, and I don't know whether it's just because of when we're watching it now, but that thing about defending our borders, you know, now I think has a sort of peculiar resonance.
It's gained a lot more meaning. Especially, you know, in the last few years.
And it is that thing where she has a world. I mean, we saw it with Charles Dickens as well last year, that sort of idea that intellectually the Victorian world kind of sees itself as having understood everything that there is to understand, having gone through a whole heap of sort of scientific revolutions.
What's that quote from Ghostlight?
Well, it is. It's like Ghostlight. She's like Light in Ghostlight. You know, she wants a comprehensible world, and the Doctor is this sort of chaotic sort of force who comes in and disrupts
it. Doesn't fit into her catalogue.
Yeah. And so this thing about sort of slamming down the borders, and then later in the year when we actually see what Torchwood has ended up being, and it's, you know, like a little outpost of the British Empire that still uses kind of imperial measurements and things. And I think just now that seems sort of particularly resonant. I was actually a bit shocked by how much I disliked Victoria in that last scene.
Mm.
She's a Victoria that would have voted for Brexit.
Well, that's right.
She didn't need to vote for Brexit. She actually has the empire that good old Brexiteers imagine that somehow we still have. She did have it.
Yeah.
So, she wouldn't have. Yeah, she's got the most bland on the planet at that point. Yeah, no, I don't think she's meant to be likable in that last scene. But I think it's meant to be It's not flat out, oh my God, you evil baddie, because she has just watched these people laugh and dance about immediately after people who are giving their lives for her, that she's known some of them a long time, are ripped to pieces by a werewolf. It's a bit of an odd reaction from her perspective, bit creepy. I wouldn't want them around either. But I don't have an empire to exile them from, so...
She does knight them, you know, immediately before that, which I think is odd as well. Like, there is this recognition that, you know, that the Doctor and her saved them and that they did do a good thing, and she gives them an honour. And it is a sort of massive surprise. And, I mean, how do Rose and the Doctor look after she suddenly changes tone and starts exiling them?
Well, like the wind's being taken out of their sails.
She might have had like a good grasp of this is the way to really get through to them. You know, I'm going to, you did save my life. I'm very grateful. I will express my gratitude in the royal way. But I'm also going to use this opportunity to let you know just how annoyed I am.
I'll put you in your place.
And she does it, of course, by saying the thing that Rose has very obviously been trying to get her to say. And it's absolutely clear that she knows all along what's going on there. And so when she comes to do that, and when Rose wins the bet and gets what she wants, there's just this shot of Rose looking horrifically embarrassed, as she should.
Yeah.
So did you know that originally, whilst Russell was scripting this story, he had actually planned to kill Victoria at the end of the episode?
What?
And yes. And that was going to be the alteration to history that created the alternate universe that we end up in, the Cybermen two-parter, and then revisit in Army of Ghosts and Doomsday.
But then what happens to real history? How do we get our universe?
He decided it was too complex for the casual viewer.
There you go. Drop
it. I kind of like that because, you know, they created an alternate timeline. They don't end up living in it, but somehow
it sort of affects the rest of the season. Yeah,
but you get the Cybermen coming up out of that and invading our universe and killing lots of people. Surely they would have had some reaction to going, oops, maybe we shouldn't have got Victoria killed. This is bad. That would have been an amazing moment, though. Just like, is she dead? Is she really dead? Is she coming back? Oh my goodness, she's dead.
Well, it's a thing that Doctor Who has never done before, has it? Like, it's got history wrong, and it kind of does that sort of fairly regularly. And even
except
here,
in the best new adventures.
But it always sort of tries to keep the shape of history kind of happening. And it's one of the problems, I think, with sort of historicals in a way, because
you can't rewrite history in not one line.
The Doctor's kind of stuck, you know, making sure things go along a sort of predetermined path. Whereas that would have been a big surprise. But I think, like, one of the things that Russell has, I think, is a real instinct for what works for the audience and keeping a sort of broad audience appeal.
I think you're right. I think Russell, more than any of the people that have come after him, understand mainstream primetime drama and what will attract a broad audience. I loved most of the last 7 years of Doctor Who, but by the end of it, it had become made for the fans. And I think they've course-corrected quite a lot in the last series, but I still think that Russell's Doctor Who was the most accessible era of the modern show.
Oh, I'd pick season 5 just because that's my favourite. But also I think actually now the 11th Hour is the sort of one that I say that's what you should start with. And if there's nothing in that that appeals to you at all, then this probably is not the show for you, kind of thing. I think that works better now as an entry point. I think season 5, if we're going for the popular, I think that works very, very well in the same kind of way. But after that, you can definitely make that argument, even though this is my favourite era of New Who and one of my favourite eras of Who. So my inclination is to defend it against all criticisms and say that it's perfect in every way, even though that might be objectively incorrect.
I mean, as a fan, I totally get where you're coming from with that. I really loved Stephen Moffat's take on Doctor Who.
No, I completely get where you're coming with the popularity thing, because this is a show that was just remembered as, you know, it was in our pop culture, but it was kind of a joke, you know, terrible special effects, wobbly sets, inverted commas, because it happened like twice. And it became the biggest show on television everyone absolutely adored. And it just got bigger and bigger and bigger under Russell's reign, as far as I remember. I'm really not good with like viewing figures and stuff. It's one of my least favorite Doctor Who topics.
I think it does get huge. I think Stolen Earth and Journey's End are sort of massive in terms of ratings. Like it's nearly as big as the show ever got. But I mean, this is a story that Moffat would never have done, simply because it is really very, very linear and simple. And, you know, I think it's telling that we're talking about lots of other things apart from the story itself. Because, you know, once you get past what it looks like, the shape of it and the main characters and the sort of conflict between them, there's not really that much to it, is there?
Yeah, I don't think it's completely flat and shallow and meaningless, but there's it would not be entirely incorrect to say there's not a great deal of depth to it. It's a very, there's nothing wrong with very plot driven, quite action adventure, great atmosphere. But it'd be very difficult, you know, if you were writing about the themes to get a lot of words out of it. You probably could if you really tried. You could get a lot in about, I guess, popular perceptions of Scotland and what this says about English writers looking at the country and what they think they can get away with or something. Though actually, I really...
Welsh writers.
Maybe.
But that's, why do we think it is in Scotland?
Because Scotland hasn't had any Doctor Who stories, hardly. We need more set in Scotland.
I'm not objecting. I'm just wondering whether there was anything particular. Is it just the prevalence of Shaolin monks?
I think it's because Queen Victoria, if you're setting it late in her reign, she spent a heck of a lot of it in Scotland, in Balmoral. And if you want to have werewolves, the feeling is more... I don't know. I guess you could set it somewhere in England in the north. There's like moors or that, but it feels more of a Scottish thing. And the last wolf in the country was killed in Scotland. We had wolves the longest. They were still wiped out in the 18th century. I think the last wolf was like
Well extinct by this point.
Yeah, I want to say 1743, but I might be well out with that.
I think that's about right. It was somewhere. I crossed that in my reading for the story. It was mid 18th century.
That's some serious research. But yeah, it fits with the theme of it. It fits with how you're feeling. And, you know, Scotland's very far away and foreign, but not too foreign. They still almost speak English there. So it's kind of thing. I think it's because it's associated with Victoria, and it's more reasonable to think maybe there is a wolf still out there, because as Victoria says, you know, there's stories. She doesn't believe there's any wolves left, but she's like, oh, stories scare the children. And I bet Victorian children would be still like, oh, there's totally wolves out there. I've been suspicious about wolves in forests before, and I knew perfectly well there weren't any out there, but maybe there were, and they're just really good at hiding for 200 years.
Less werewolf and more werewolf. That's terrible. I'm sorry. I'm not sorry.
So good. Quality punning.
Sorry.
Don't apologise. That was quality.
For me, I guess the thing that stands out here is it's the first time that Doctor Who has been really sort of confident to just base a whole story on essentially action, that they find themselves in a position where they can do lots of proper running around in a sort of expansive location and set an episode which largely consists of running away from the monster and then sort of stopping and regrouping and then running away from the monster. And I think that that's something that hasn't really properly been tried, simply because technically it wasn't a possibility.
Yeah.
And
generally you make them lumbering and slow menace, don't you? Historically speaking, Cybermen, Ice Warriors, Daleks. Yeah.
I could definitely see this being stretched out to like six parts in the 60s. I could see how they'd do that. It would not be as good, I don't think. Even though I'm very much for give me all the padding that you like, I don't mind, lovely 60s Who. That's not padding, that's character development, sort of.
Yeah.
it's meat on the bone.
But, yeah.
Well, it varies from story to story, doesn't it?
No. Let's not live in our fantasy world.
But yeah, this does have that feel like they've gone, well, let's see how you like our base under siege with pacing in it.
With, and that is it, isn't it? It is a
literal
proper
pacing.
Base under siege too. I mean, we haven't had one since, well, actually probably last week with New Earth, which has a little base under siege moment where they all go into quarantine and sort of zombies start lumbering around the place. But this is a little bit more of a trad base under siege. And that comparison with Horror of Fang Rock, complete with its, you know, mythical tales of a beast and no one can get out and all of that sort of thing, you know, that's a sort of classic base under siege. So, yeah, maybe that's they're doing a base under siege at speed.
On speed.
Have there even been any quite fast monsters in New Who by this point? I was just thinking through them.
Except for those Slitheen in those CG shows.
Yes, that's a sort of difficult. Well, they don't come across as that limber when we're seeing the costumes. So it's no. Like, are they actually that fast, or was that a trick of the light? Because I'm trying to. It's difficult for me to get the kind of like headcanon in there that they were actually that fast, because I don't believe it. I think they were lumbering rubber suits. I love them. I love those stories, but...
Oh, me too. Absolutely adore them. Fantastic.
Hugely underrated. And so much fun.
Oh, wonderful. Just superb.
Isn't that your favourite two-parter of the new series?
No, it's not. I still like Bad Wolf and Parting of the Ways an enormous amount, but certainly that two-parter is wonderful. It's just where the hell's it going to go next? The scale of it.
You know,
like it's so great.
The first watch of it, but... I remember, it was so good. even just at the start, we were like, oh my gosh, they're a year later and they've come back. This was so new and novel and exciting. Oh, such a long time ago now. That's terrible.
Yeah.
And it's got plenty of Camille Kadouri.
Well, that's right. That's it. She's so great. Listener, we've defeated the werewolf, and so we're heading back home to do some Ofsted-style school inspections and maybe to meet up with an old friend. We'll see you next week for school reunion. In the meantime, you can find us at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and Apple Podcasts, and at FTE Podcast on Twitter. You can also find us at our Series 11 Flashcast, Jodie into Terror, which is at jodieintoterror.com. And over on Bondfinger, we've completely run out of Bond films and we've started making commentaries on a variety of other spy movies. You can find that at bondfinger.com, Bondfinger on Facebook and Apple Podcasts, and at Bondfingercast on Twitter. Liz, where can people find you?
They can find me on Twitter at LM Miles and... at my website with my very regularly updated blog at www.lmmiles.com. Also, if I'm allowed to do a quick plug.
Of course. Absolutely.
Also, there's the first 12th Doctor adventure from Big Finish is coming out in February. And yes! It's a short story called The Astria Conspiracy. And it's written
I'm
by
so
me.
I'm so excited.
And if you'd like to pre-order it, I'd be ever so grateful.
I already have.
Oh, thank you. Bless you.
Brilliant. Well, look, thank you so much for agreeing to join us. It's been fantastic talking to you today.
Thank you for having me on your lovely show. It's been a delight.
Thank you. Well, until next time, may you remember to bring plenty of mistletoe the next time you're invited to the Royal Garden Party. Thank you very much for listening and good night.
Good night.
Good morning.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Nathan Bottomley, James Selwood, and special guest star Lisbeth Miles. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb, strings performance by Jane Orberg. This episode, Having a Laugh About Werewolves, was recorded on the 20th of January 2019 and released on the 24th of March. If anyone out there knows Josh the Werewolf, would you mind asking him to get in touch? No pressure or anything, just for a drink. We'll see how it goes from there. All right. I don't know. We should...
Possibly. Indulge me?
Yes, please.
So, you know where the title comes from.
Tennyson.
Yes.
Well, that was quick.
No. Like, so family history?
No.
My father's great aunt married Lord Tennyson.
Really?
Yeah. What?
Maybe there aren't enough greats in there.
God.
Yeah. No, Emily Selwood.
Wow. Do you have a Wikipedia page?
Do I?
Yeah.
I think I do.
You should.
Is that okay? Wow. Yeah. That's amazing.
Like, I don't have. I only discovered this in the last couple of years.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's very cool.
Kind of cool. It's kind of cool. Not a direct descendant or anything.
But you still feel that you could take a little bit of credit for this episode.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. Repeaterites, I would think. So it is a strange choice for the title, do you think? Did we have Queen Victoria as a... That would have been just a sort of rough working title.
So Queen Victoria, because it was the Queen Victoria story. But I think, choosing a line from a poem by her poet laureate,
yeah,
is appropriate.
Yeah,
it describes
the monster.
It does what it says on the tin.
Yeah. I guess that's fair enough.
Mm.
And keeping with the kind of, I don't want to say literalism, that's a bit extreme, but keeping kind of straightforwardness of the story. You know, you don't want an out there title to just accidentally confuse you and think it might be deep. It's not a Babylon 5 episode, if that helps.